Thank you for being here on this last day of a great conference. Hope you're enjoying it. This talk is on the challenges of working in multicultural environment. I come from Switzerland, which is a country which has four official languages, and I would say four cultures. You know, it's just, you might say it's the same country, we speak a different language, but this has impact on the culture, and sometimes we don't understand each other. And I've been working in Apache projects since 2000, about. And of course, then you see lots of different cultures, maybe not as much as we would like to, could be better, but still, you're exposed to, you know, just talk. I work for Adobe. I'm a principal scientist attached to the Basel office doing content management stuff. So I have colleagues from California. You might think it's, you know, it's the same Occidental culture. It shouldn't be that different. But there are lots of subtle things which sometimes get in the way. On the Apache side, I'm currently on the board of directors. Been doing that for some time. And it's also an interesting group of people who are quite opinionated. And I love listening. If you've been on the board call, so any Apache members are welcome to join the board calls if you want, if you have time for that. And I just love listening to the accents. Just you have Ross Gardler with the British accent and Brett Porter from Down Under and myself with this, I don't know, European accent. And it's interesting. And we are going to have a story. Story is about the sinking ship. And sometimes our projects, Joan was mentioning, nuclear level conflicts. And I think sometimes we also have some sinking ships, and we'll see how that works or how that didn't work in this case. I think the cultural diversity is a great asset. It's fantastic to be able to work with people who have slightly different ideas, see things from a different angle, put the emphasis on different things that I would, and that I think that gives better. In the end, we get a better quality result in our projects. But it makes the communication harder because you have your own cultural background that influences how you say things and how you perceive things. And especially on low bandwidth channels like written communications, emails, or pull requests, or chat channels, it's harder than face-to-face. So we have, we have lots of challenges in this area. So what's your culture? Who's coming from the United States? Okay, about half of the people. Who's from Canada? 2-3 people, great. Who's from Europe? 2 Europeans, yes. And then that's one axis. Who's a soccer fan? We have any soccer fans? Yes, we have 2 soccer fans in the audience. Who's a musician? A few of them, yeah. Who loves to read books on a hill, like, you know, who would like this afternoon, it's sunny, to go up, what's the name of this hill again? Sorry. Mont-Royal. Who would like to sit there on top of this, the Mont-Royal, and read a book in the afternoon? Yeah, I love doing that. You know, so the culture is not just defined by where you come from or what language you speak, but there's many axes to this, which do sometimes get in the way of our communications. The typical failure scenario that I see is that it starts with a bad decision. That happens. Everybody does bad decisions from time to time. And then the problem is in the middle. There's misunderstandings. There's no course correction. You know, like maybe I say something stupid on a list, and the best thing if someone tells me immediately, Bertrand, this, you shouldn't say it like that. It's, you know, English is not my mother tongue, so sometimes I don't express myself as I would like to. So if someone corrects me quickly, that's okay. Case closed, I did a mistake, it's over. If it doesn't happen, then that's when you get disasters. You know, I think it's really important, the course correction. It would be fantastic if we never made mistakes, but we are human, so I don't think that will ever happen. I could have found a good number of examples in the ESF, of course, of such conflicts which go a bad way. So as I said, I've been active for 18 years now in the ESF, so you'd find a lot of examples where I was involved. This would be a bit painful, so I was not too keen on going in that direction. And luckily, I found another example. As I was saying, it's about a ship. So I live on a lake in Switzerland. I do some sailing as well. And when you sail, okay, in my lake, I know it, so I can go, you know, without doing too many map work. But if I'm sailing at sea, then you look at your map and you decide what's the course that you want to follow. And the goal is to avoid the dangers. If you're sailing a boat, then there might be rocks that you don't want to hit, or you don't want to hit an island, or, you know, there's many things. Now there's more and more windmills, wind farms, that you have to avoid as well. And it's all shown on the map. So it should be easy. You look at the map, look for the dangers, and then you plot a course that defines how you're going to avoid that. The problem is the scale of the map. If you have a map that's not detailed enough, you might be missing things. You know, this red thing on the left looks pretty okay. You're giving some space between yourself and the island. But if you zoom in on the second and third chart excerpt here, you see that you're actually going to be pretty close to some rocks, and it might not be a fantastic idea. It depends on the weather as well. You know, so here, if you have a wind which is going the direction of the black arrow, we'll be pushing your ship against the rocks. That's not a fantastic idea. But as I said, so you could say, okay, this navigation plan is not a good idea. It's actually even a bad one. But you're not alone on the ship. Especially if it's a big ship, you have officers, you have a first mate, you have people who are expected to challenge your decision. Say, hey, Captain, I don't feel good about this thing. You know, we have the wind pushing us, and our boat, our ship weighs I don't know how many tons. It's certainly not a good idea. So you should avoid that. And in our projects, it's the same thing. You know, we are expected to respectfully challenge others' opinions and steer them the right way. The case that I'm talking about here, I don't know if you hear about or you heard about this on this side of the pond, Costa Concordia. It's a really big cruise ship that crashed on the Giglio Island near the coast of Italy. And it really happened. You know, it's a very sad story. It's interesting, as is always the case in marine accidents, the report is public, so you can read it and study it, and that's what I did. So I had a closer look. So first thing, here on top left, you see the actual map that they used. It's really not a good chart. You know, it's an old one, and they have some crappy penciled-in instructions. It doesn't look serious. If I'm sailing a 40-foot boat, I think I would be more serious than that. And this is a ship. But what's interesting about this story, I don't want to bore you with sailing stuff, but what's interesting is that they had the personnel of the ship was, they had 38 different nationalities on the ship, which is a challenge, you know, getting these people to understand each other and to do a common thing so that everything works well, it's not easy. On top of that, the company decided to use Italian as the official communication language on the ship. I suppose the percentage of people who spoke actually Italian was very small. And this says what happened. If you read the report, so there was a trial, of course, it was a big accident, so there was a serious investigation. The first engineer testified that he does not fully understand the orders that the captain is giving in Italian. That's not a good thing. First engineer, you know, the guy who's in charge of the engines of the boat, which are very important. The helmsman, the person who was actually steering the boat, testified that he did not at times understand the master's orders, which were given in English. So Italian is a working language, but it's not working, so, you know, we use English, and they still don't understand. And there is an actual dialogue here where the captain says, you know, bearing should be 325, and the helmsman confirms 315. And then the first deck officer says, hey, this is wrong. It should be 335. And then the helmsman says, oh, 325, actually. You know, it took like four iterations to go to get this right. So when you have a ship like that going at 16 knots, which is probably way too fast for going where they were going with a crappy navigation plan, it's a recipe for disaster. And really, the disaster, once again, I think happened in the middle of this three-stage thing. The captain's navigation plan was not good, but it could be fixed. It probably took 3 hours since they plotted this course until the accident happened. So there was plenty of time to challenge the decisions and say, "Captain, this is not going on." And if it's really, if the captain was drunk or I don't know what, you can do something. It should be possible. It didn't happen, and then you get a disaster. So I think it's really we need the efficient communications, and we need to understand each other to avoid the disasters. Our disasters in our projects are luckily much smaller, but still, we've had projects go down in flames because people were just don't understand each other anymore or don't agreeing to work together. So it can be serious problems. And I think a lot of that is due or the cultural backgrounds get in the way. There's so many ways in which you can screw up. I lived 1 year in California, and I have at least 20 or 30 anecdotes where I looked really stupid. I come out of my house in the morning, and the neighbor comes and says, "Hey, Bertrand, how are you doing today?" I say, "Oh, I'm doing okay. Well, I sleep well. My little daughter is doing good." He says, "I don't care." Here, when I'm asking you, how are you doing? You reply, "How are you doing?" And that's it. It ends up here. If I want to know, I'll ask a different question. That's just a social convention, And then you look stupid. It's a small thing, but it's the kind of mishaps that happen. So if I tell you there is a zebra crossing around the corner, for some people it's obvious. A zebra crossing is a place where pedestrians go to cross the road. And if I don't know that, there's zebras in Montreal. Really? I want to see that. I want to go around that corner. These kinds of idioms and expressions that we use. When you meet someone, do you kiss? In Switzerland, if I meet someone who's my age and I don't know them, I will not kiss them on the first encounter. It's when we get a bit closer, then we kiss on the cheek. And in Switzerland, it's 3 times. In France, it's 2 times or 4 times, depending on where you are. And then it's really minor thing, but it shows how many things can go wrong. If you drink alcohol, first, where do you drink alcohol? Is it okay if you're at work and you go at lunch with someone? If you do that in France, usually you would get a glass of wine if people like wine. If you do that in some countries, they say, "These guys are drinking wine during work. That it's not right." And then if you drink alcohol, how do you cheer? In Switzerland, we have very specific rules about that. If you get wine, if you get another bottle of the same wine, you don't cheer again. But if you get wine, a different wine, then you cheer again. And it has to be done in a very specific way. And it's wine country, so they have their own traditions. There's so many things that can go wrong. Gestures, the dive man okay sign in some countries means something bad. So you have to be careful with that. It's the Tower of Babel again. We think we are speaking the same language. We all speak English, so it's easy. But then when it becomes subtle or when it becomes tense, you can easily get in trouble. I'm going to tell you a joke. Jokes are also very cultural and very regional. And that's also where you can really fall on your face when you try a joke in a different culture and people, "Oh, is that the joke, actually?" So that's actually a guess. You have to guess what's the difference between a duck. And usually when the first people might ask it, "Between a duck and what?" No, it's what's the difference between a duck? And I don't know if anyone knows. If you were at First Backstage, I already did this talk, so maybe you know it. If you don't know, it's that both legs are the same length, especially the left one. It is a joke, and some people will find it funny, some people will find it totally stupid, some people will find it's not even a joke, and it's not a very risky one because it's family safe, it's not a problem. But just to show that the subtler you get in the humor, and the harder it gets, and when you're trying to do humor in email, because you want to be friendly to your project colleagues, it can really go wrong. Because first the cultural humor is not the same, then the email gets in the way, it's not precise the way you express yourself, people don't see when you're making a smile, so you have to be very explicit so that it works. Another thing, that's also something that I learned when I lived in California. People taught me to express my appreciation. You know, when someone does something good, you tell them actively. You know, John, your talk was great. I really enjoyed it. It was really cool. In my country, in my area, we don't tend to do that. If I don't say anything bad, it's a good sign. You know, if I'm quiet, you should be happy. And if I say, it was not bad. That's a really good compliment where I come from, you know. And some other people will say, oh, it was awesome. You know, it was fantastic. The best talk I heard since many months, and it's crazy. And that's also culture. You know, it's where you set the bar, how do you express things. This is from Twitter, retweeted by my friend Mark Stroberg. The opposite, you know, when you criticize something, or you're not happy with something. So, okay, he's using country stereotypes. That's not very good, but that's part of the... I didn't write that. But someone will say, this study is deeply flawed because of this reason, you know. It is wrong. Okay, if someone tells me that, it's hard for me to take that. If they tell me my work is wrong, that's hard to accept. And someone, someone from the UK here might be, pardon my skepticism, but could it be that X is a bit of a problem here? Do we maybe have a problem? You know, we say the same thing, but in much softer, much, to me, nicer way. And then it's not fair they say, okay, the Americans would, but some people would say it like that. It's absolutely amazing. That's the best study I've seen ever. X might not be totally relevant, but it's a great study, right? They're all saying the same thing, but in a very different way. And depending on where you come from, you will perceive that very, very differently. Another fun thing is they're also from, I'm quoting people from Twitter today, tu et vous. You know, in French, in English, it's you. But I think even in English, there's a polite form. If I say Mr. Fisher, that's different from saying Dave. And that, you know, there's still a subtle polite form. But in French, we have tu ou vous. Vous being the polite form and tu being the more familiar form. And this person has been creating, a chart or a decision chart of how do you decide to say tu ou vous to someone. And it's actually like that in French. It's, you know, if you meet someone, that person is older, you will tend to say vous, and if they're younger, you might say tu, and if it's at work, in some companies they say tu, in others they say vous, and it's different in France or in Switzerland, and the age, my kids will tend to say, my kids, they are 30 years old now, they will tend to say tu on the first encounter, and my parents would say vous for 10 years, and then I think we can go to tu, and they had ceremony for going to two, they would drink in a special way, and then you can do that. Crazy stuff, you know. But this also, if I go to a conference in France, even, you know, here, if we were that kind of crowd in Switzerland, we would say two, you know, from the get-go when you meet people. If I do that in France, people might say vous for a few hours until you had a meal together or something. So it's also some subtle things where you can fall on your face. When you're in face-to-face conversations, it's much easier to steer that because you can make a face. You know, you can express to someone immediately that you're not comfortable with, oh, you're saying to me? I would expect you to say vous, something like that. In email or in written communications, it's much harder. And you have a lag. It might take 5 hours until you get a reply that tells you, I don't like the way this conversation is going. So it's complicated. And we have to be very careful how we handle that in our online discussions. Here's another axis of culture that I wanted to express. So there are many axes to the culture. I'm sorry, this is another catastrophic event that happened, the Challenger space shuttle. It's not that I like these events, they're very sad things. But the good thing about these problems, they are big problems, and you have official reports. So you can look at this and try to understand what happened, what went wrong in this case. And here, what happened, so this was 1985, I think, or six. And what happened is that they launched the space shuttle, and the temperature on the launch pad was much lower than it had been for the other launches. And the engineers knew that some of the O-ring seals, you call that a seal, could be problematic when it was cold. And some of them were convinced that it was going to be a problem. The problem is that the way they expressed that was in an engineering style. You see the box in the middle here. They had lists of, you know, bullet lists of problems. The temperature is lower than this. The seals are, the O-rings are known to be problematic under this temperature. So we think there might be a problem. And, you know, just listing the points, which are might be difficult to understand for someone who's not in engineering. It gets a bit technical. And the people who had to make the decisions, they don't really understand that way of talking. There was also, of course, a trial, or, you know, investigation, and probably a trial on this thing. And the diagram in the middle is from Edward Tufte. I don't know if you know Edward Tufte. He has fantastic books on graphical representation of information. I love them. They're beautifully set up, fantastic. And he was involved. He was called as an expert in the investigation, and he came up with this diagram, which really explains the problem in a very obvious way. The dots on the diagram, they are the launches, and on the horizontal axis you have the temperature, left is colder, and then on the vertical axis you have the problems. How many problems, or what's the size of the problems that they had with the O-rings on these launches. So on the right you see many launches that went well, had zero or very few problems, temperature was pretty high. And then in the middle, you see the temperature getting lower and the problems go up. And if you make a curve, it's easy to imagine that it's kind of an exponential curve. And the launch of Challenger was here. You know, so it's pretty obvious that you're going to have problems. And sometimes we engineers say, the managers, you know, they're not as clever as us. They're just managers. That's not fair. But even if you showed that to someone who understands nothing of engineering, it would be relatively easy to tell them, we should not launch this thing. It's very likely that we're going to have problems. So what I'm getting at is that when you're collaborating in a team, you have engineers, you have managers, you have maybe a venture capitalist, I don't know why. It's slightly different cultures in the way you communicate and in the way you collaborate. So you have to adjust the message. You have to try to find a way to communicate with that person that matches their culture, be it a national or language culture, or also a culture of their trade, engineering, management, or something like that. So this doesn't make things easier. I'm basically telling you that there's many cultural axes that are involved when we communicate with people, and it's hard to do that in writing, which is what we do all the time. And and there are, maybe you didn't think before today, that there can be 10 or 20 axes that influence the culture, the way you communicate. So it would be good to reflect on how we can fix that. So once again, what we need to fix is the middle box here to make sure we can course correct when bad decisions are made, because they will happen. Bad decisions, bad actions, bad behaviors. It's something that does happen from time to time. Luckily, we're not the only industry to have this problem. And an example that I like is from the aviation industry. They have, airplanes all over the world. And the technical documentation is in English, but it's English is not their first language, so it might be harder to understand. So this industry has defined a simplified technical English language to make that safer, you know. And the aviation manuals, they are written in these ASD, ST100 language standard, with a reduced vocabulary, with grammar rules which are limited, and with many examples on how you write things, so that someone who has a basic level of English can understand really what you mean. And I have a small example here. For example, the second line, On the left was all valves must be turned slowly in order to prevent strong steam jets, which can damage both hose lines and components. It's a bit complicated. And the simplified version is turn all valves slowly to prevent strong jets of steam. It's pretty, you know, it's much more obvious. And I think we should, I'm not saying we should write our messages in this simplified English, maybe not this variant, but it's a good thing to do. When you're communicating on mailing lists or in public, in pull requests and in written form, it's a good thing to try to stick to a simple language. Even if you're, you know, you're a native English speaker and you're writing lots of books and maybe you're reading books and maybe even writing them, try to keep to a simple language. Or if you go into something more rhetoric and more complex, maybe mark it up, you know, say, oh, okay, this is more philosophical or something, but try to really stick to simple language for the core message. I think that that's very helpful. You know, and the rules are pretty simple. If you use active voice, present tense, short phrases, concise messages, I have a theory that the shorter, if you're writing an email, the shorter it is, the more likely people will read it. You know, when I see walls of text coming on our mailing list, very often, sometimes I just even don't have time to read them, or very often I just ignore them. So if you're writing, it's a good, now we have the habit of having the TLDR, saying, okay, I'm writing a long email, but basically what I mean is this. So you can decide if you want to read the rest or not, and that's very helpful. But sometimes the best thing is to write a short message, and if it's about the more complex you know, architecture or something, put it somewhere else. Put it on a wiki with a permanent URL or in the pull request description. But I think shorter message are very shorter and simpler message are very, very helpful. So I'm not a specialist of language theory. I'm sure there are many people who could explain that better than me. I'm a pragmatic guy, and I'm fascinated by how our communities operate, so I'll try to give some hopefully useful recommendations. The first one is to assume good intentions. You know, when you see someone has written something nasty or that you consider to be nasty on the mailing list, you know, even if you... often you have a preconception, oh, they want to attack me, they don't like my work, I'm a bad guy, anything. Try to assume, you know, people usually don't want to do bad things. If they really want, then you have to do something, but very often we overreact because of misunderstandings. Ask for clarification. Always try to reformulate, you know, when someone writes something that you feel is attacking you or your work, reformulate and make sure you understand what was actually trying to be said. I think that's useful. In terms of ego, when you do that, you're being very candid. So it can be a bit, you know, I'm on the board of directors and we have monthly phone meetings. And sometimes I don't understand because someone says a slang word or an expression that I don't know. And I have to ask. And we have a back channel using IRC, so I will ask on the back channel. Sometimes you feel a bit stupid. I remember one case when so we voted on something on the board and I said yes and something. And someone said, oh, Bertrand had a signing statement. I had no clue what a signing statement means, you know. And then what you do? You're shy, or you think if I ask, I'm going to look stupid, or you ask. You say, "I'm sorry, I don't know what a signing statement is. Can you briefly explain, or later, if it's not a good time now, whatever." So you have to be a bit candid, and it needs some humility to do that. But in the end, the goal is you want to communicate precisely and avoid misunderstandings. So you have to do that. Another thing that we can do, and this is more for the documentation or when you're discussing, for example, a new architecture for a project or for a module in a project, it's sometimes easy to write long walls of text to explain what you want to do, but you know that a graphic, you know, is worth 1,000 words, we say in French. I don't know if you also say that in English. And here, I think that's a good example. Okay, if you see a sign that says seniors at play, we don't exactly know what this means. I think the graphic on the right is really, you know, if you're driving, they are apparently elderly people or people who have a hard time moving. I should be careful. It's very obvious. We can do the same with computer stuff. You know, if you describe your new architecture with a drawing, I often do really back of the envelope drawings. I do a quick drawing on a piece of paper, I scan it, and I add it to my pull request or something to explain what I'm doing very quickly. It's useful. And then, it often takes less time. And if you cannot do a good drawing, it's usually a sign that your thing is not as good as it should be. You know, it should be expressed easily. So try to, of course, we communicate in text because it's email or pull request text, but it doesn't prevent you from having graphics somewhere that you can link to. I think that's also useful. And one thing that we do very well as programmers is communicating with code. You know, if you're trying to convince people of a new architecture, if you can do a minimal prototype, it can be crappy, it can be ugly, it can be unfinished, but often it will be much easier for people to understand what you're trying to do than a long explanation or a combination of both, you know. And this is something also that I see often in our projects where we talk too much and we could spend the same amount of time doing a prototype and then have people have a look at it and then you have discussion, but starting from a con basis, that's much clearer. I think I already said that, but just maybe to stress that point. If you do jokes, which I think it's good. I mean, it's good to have, and Joan was mentioning that as well, with a side, you know, the unarchived side channel. We need the social interactions. I'm working remotely. So I'm an Adobe employee, but I work remotely. I'm working from people who are all over the planet. And it feels lonely sometimes. You need to have some social interactions. And jokes are part of that. But as I mentioned, the jokes are a bit difficult in a multicultural environment. So you can be very explicit. I'm going to tell you a joke, and maybe you won't consider it even a joke. If you feel offended, tell me and I'll stop, you know, something like that. It's a balance to find. Sometimes I find that the political correctness can be very boring. If I have to explain you that it's a joke and why it's a joke, it's a bit difficult. So I think it's a balance to find. And the more you know the people, the less you need that. But initially, I think you have to be careful. And on the mailing list, it can be as simple as putting a joke tag or irony or something like that. So people can, this doesn't feel good to me, but it's supposed to be irony, so I hope I can ignore it. That might be one way. And then you can be, this is also something that many people could explain better than me, but phrasing things in a friendly and constructive way, you know, and putting yourself in question. On the left is an answer that I actually wrote in one of our internal mailing lists at work. When I say I'm freaking out, but then I say I'm freaking out in a friendly way with a smiley. So I'm freaking out, but, you know, don't take it too seriously. And then, I don't like to be married to a service provider, so can we do something? And then the question is, can you reassure me that we're not doing that? Or can we work together? Can I help you avoid this problem? Try to, you know, offer a way to say, I don't like what we're doing here. I don't feel comfortable about it, but I'm ready to try to help. Instead of saying, this is all wrong and we shouldn't do that and we should stop doing it, that's not good. Or if someone calls your work substandard or something like that, what do you exactly mean by substandard? Do you think we should not do that? Or maybe my code, you don't like my code because you don't feel it's good enough? Or maybe I didn't understand, maybe I didn't really understand what you mean. You know, leave the door open to say, I think it's wrong, but maybe it's just we're not communicating as we should. Or if someone calls your code a piece of shit, then you can just say, calling my code a piece of shit makes me uncomfortable. Maybe in your culture, maybe in your work team, you do that all the time and you're fine with it. That happens. And in some teams, it's like that. For me, it makes me uncomfortable. Can we be more constructive, or can you be more explicit so we can find out what the actual problem is? And of course, you could jump, you know, say, you're insulting me, that's not right, nobody should ever do that, and I'm not your friend anymore, and we're going to stop. You could do that, and sometimes you have to, if it's really too bad. But that's also things, the use of strong language. What exactly is strong language? It's also very different from culture to culture, and even from among, I'm sure if you look at the US, it's very different from one state to the other. People will react differently to that. So I'm saying, we need to be focused like a warrior, but friendly like a care bear. You know, so you really, there's a goal. The goal is, I want this project to work. I want what you're doing to be successful. But I'll try to be friendly so that we can work around the differences. So that's Uncle Bertrand's recommendations, you know, this. But basically trying to not be too strict and be open to clarification or to an evolution of the conversation. Because you really want that course correction. You don't want the thing to go, you know, you don't want that ship to sink. I was quite active more than 10 years ago in the Apache Cocoon project, and that's one of my favorite examples of an Apache community, because in this project there were maybe 20 to 30 active committers, and everybody was from a small company or consultant. It was all small shops, 2-3 people, and we are all, our business was dependent on Cocoon. I was a consultant at the time. I was doing content management stuff based on Cocoon. So when things go wrong, you can't say, okay, I'm leaving. You know, I'm off. That's my business. I can't do that. So we had to find ways to, and there were some pretty opinionated people in that team. But we made it work. We because there was the need to, the business need to do stuff, then you find a way to fix it, and that's really the goal. We shouldn't if you're getting depressed on something, you need to do something. But in general, we can. I'm sure in many cases we can steer the conversations to be more constructive. So this is the coda. The word comes from my musical background, culture. So really, the bad decisions and bad actions do happen. Nobody's perfect. We need to accept that. And what makes the difference is a course correction. You know, like in the ship, sinking ship example, it was not lost until maybe half an hour between the thing really happened. And it could have been fixed if someone had respectfully, maybe they tried, I don't know. But if there was a conversation, why, you know, we think it's not working, we need to do something and understand each other. And then you for that to work, you need good communications, where you verify that there are no misunderstandings by reformulating, by writing things down, so you make sure you're talking about the same thing. And be careful of the hidden cultural obstacles, because there's many ways this can happen. And don't be afraid to, you know, ask and double check to avoid these misunderstandings. So that's my conclusion. We have a few minutes we have 10 minutes for questions if you want. On the other hand, it's lunchtime, so I don't want to block you from that, but I'm happy to take questions if you have any.